Dude, ring the bell, sucker. This is Movie Fighters, the show where Chris Sims of ComicsAlliance.com and elsewhere on the internet, and I, Matt Wilson, we watch movies and we beat them up. And this time, we're doing something very odd. We're doing our very last Kickstarter donor demand.
It has been a long road, Matt.
How long have we been doing these? We did like kick off our Kickstarter like almost a year ago. It feels like we've been doing these Kickstarter demands for a year. We have not. We've been doing them for a few months. But yeah, boy, it has been quite a trip.
let's talk about what we've done. Since we're at the point where the Kickstarter demands, I refuse to call them requests. They are demands that have been put upon us. Let's talk about the movies we have done. We have done Short Circuit 2, which was garbage.
Yeah, that one was tough.
We did Inframan, which was actually pretty good, the Chinese superhero movie.
Yes, I enjoyed that one quite a bit. And let's actually like make a scorecard here.
Okay. Wins and losses? Wins and losses, is that what we're doing?
Yeah, or just like good and bad, like what we liked and what we didn't.
Okay. Let's run through them.
So, okay, I'm trying to decide, remember which ones of these were actual listener requests.
None of the holiday ones were listener requests. So right. The two Draculas and the Christmas Bounty were not listener requests.
Okay. So we did Inframan, which we liked.
Yes.
AKA Super Inframan.
Very enjoyable. Weird, but enjoyable.
We did Short Circuit 2, which we hated.
I don't think I'm going to San Diego this year, which is great because I would probably get in a fist fight with David Willis for making us watch that movie.
We did Gun Crazy, which we liked quite a bit.
Kinda loved it. Kind of actually loved it.
Myra Breckinridge, which is the worst
movie. Literally the worst movie I've ever seen.
We've ever watched. We did The Calamari Wrestler, which we enjoyed quite a bit.
Weird, but enjoyable.
Yes. We almost didn't mention our very first episode of the iTunes era of Movie Fighters, which was He-Man and She-Ra, Secret of the Sword.
I know we watched that. I know we recorded the episode. I could not tell you a single fact about that movie.
It was awful and boring. Those are facts about that movie. And then on our previous episode, we watched Black Samurai, which was pretty good.
Very enjoyable. So we're kind of like
split.
That's pretty even split.
I think Dude, Where's My Car with Commentary, which is the movie that we're watching this episode.
And that is the weirdest request we've ever had.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I still don't fully understand why commentary was part of the request. The way that it was explained in the demand that we got from this Kickstarter backer, Luke McClung, is thus: can I make y'all watch Dude, Where's My Car with the creator commentary on? They tell all the jokes they would have used if they could have made the movie R-rated.
Oh, so this is too hot for theaters.
Too hot for PG-13.
This is like a Judd Apatow unrated edition.
That's right. And I'm going to tell you who the commentary is with. It's with the two stars, Ashton Kutcher.
Ash Catch.
And Sean William Scott.
Sean Willie of The Rundown.
That's A plus K.
A plus K.
And Sean Willie.
A plus K, who had to stop using Twitter after he saw that Joe Paterno had been fired and did not know why and just said it was due to a lack of respect.
Yes.
And then stopped using Twitter.
And then the director, Danny, I'm going to say Liner, is the third participant in the commentary. Now here's a fact. Some of the movies we've been able to watch on Movie Fighters, when we've been able to not have to go to that much trouble to get. Now, like, the Calamari Wrestler was a little hard to get a hold of.
The Calamari Wrestler was hard, but that's mainly because it's one of those movies that they have, like, four copies of total at Netflix. So it's always a weird long wait video.
Right. This one, Dude, Where's My Car? Is a readily available film to watch in lots of places. But in order to get the commentary, we had to obtain the DVD. Now, Chris, in your case, you ordered it from Netflix on DVD.
Right, I'm still hanging on to the discs, bro.
And you got it that way.
Still
I ordered a used copy on Amazon that was $2.99, which I'd say is about $2.89 too much. And because of weather where I live, I waited like more than a week to get. I got Prime, bro. I got Prime. And I waited over a week for this Dude Where's My Car DVD. I could not imagine being more happy to see the UPS guy drive up to deliver
a copy of Dude Where's My Car.
A Dude Where's My Car DVD.
Now, this is probably, I would say, the maybe not biggest budget, but like certainly it's the most real movie we've done in a while. Like, I guess Dracula Untold probably had a decent amount of budget. We saw it in the theater. But yeah. Dude, Where's My Car was a hit.
Yeah, I'd say this is the most popular movie that we have watched.
Even more popular than Black Samurai, though, do you think?
In terms of, yes. Like, here's the thing about Dude, Where's My Car? And there's actually a section on Wikipedia about that, about this. Against all common sense, against all conventional wisdom, Dude, Where's My Car has become like a cultural touchstone since it was made in the year 2000. It has become a thing that people reference. There's a list of different things, the legacy of Dude, Where's My Car on Wikipedia. Here are some of the things that are listed. Author and filmmaker Michael Moore published a book titled Dude, Where's My Country, criticizing the United States' response to 9/11. And at a 2005 Philadelphia 76ers games, then 76er Kyle Korver quoted the movie for a contest where fans guessed the movie a 76ers player was quoting. In 2012, this was 3 years ago. Not even 3 years ago.
And this movie came out in the 90s, right?
The year 2000 was when it came out. The Pittsburgh Pirates started using the Zoltan hand signal from the movie as a way for players to congratulate their teammates after an accomplishment such as a home run or a double play. The habit started after the Pirates were watching Dude, Where's My Car in the visiting clubhouse at Turner Field in Atlanta during an April 2012 weekend series against the Atlanta Braves.
Okay, so quick question. Is this a Warner Brothers film?
It is a 20th Century Fox film.
Okay, so then why do they just have it in the visiting team's dugout at Turner Field?
It's mind games, bro.
That is so bizarre. Like, of all the places to stumble across Dude, Where's My Car? Just to have it, you know what? Maybe it was on TBS, because I bet those TVs are tuned to TBS. But no, it can't be, because I can't imagine there being a Braves game not being broadcast on TBS.
Well, this was probably before the game, so maybe it was tuned to TBS before the game. I don't know. But there's okay, like,
so bare minimum, we know that Dude, Where's My Car is more exciting than watching baseball.
Yeah, but there's like a cultural touchstone.
Okay,
in Dude, Where's My Car?
Here's what makes this weird. I've never seen this movie.
Me neither. So we're watching this. You and I are.
First time you watch this movie is going to be with the commentary on, taking notes for this show.
Yeah, we are not watching it without the commentary. We are only watching it with the commentary. Because here's the thing. I would hate to watch this movie with the commentary off. I may hate watching it with the commentary on. But if there's one thing that I just cannot get that just does not appeal to me in any way at all, it's stoner humor.
Like any stoner humor?
Half-Baked is maybe the only exception.
Really? So you don't like a Harold and Kumar?
No.
Really? I love Harold and Kumar. The first one, anyway.
I don't know. There's something about, like...
I mean, look, I should say I loved it when I was, 24 or however old I was when it came out.
Yeah, right.
It's been a while.
I end up just getting angry at the characters for being, kind of out of it all the time. For whatever reason, in Half-Baked, it doesn't bother me so much. I think
does this stress you out, Matt? Is this a source of stress for you when these characters are too impaired?
Yeah.
They find themselves in weird situations.
It makes me frustrated. I'm just like, ask somebody to help you. Figure it out, man. Like, I popped this movie in. I'm looking at the menu screen right now.
The menu screen is worrisome.
You know those great 2000 animated menus?
Oh.
When animated menus used to be a feature on the back of the DVD box? Okay, so I saw the previews for, Fox DVD, Catch the Fever, or whatever, right?
Catch the Fever, Fox DVD.
Yeah, and then you hit the menu screen, and it's just, bubbles and watery, bubbly sounds, like it's bong water, I suspect. But it also kind of looks like a lava lamp, just with the logo for the movie in front of it. It's lazy as hell for a menu. But it's also just like, I absolutely know exactly what I'm getting into with this, and I'm already stressed out. I'm already, at that level of anxiety and tension that I get from watching stoner-related media.
Now, see, here's what bugs me about it, is that I feel like I could enjoy this movie. I don't think I will. I think I have been living a Dude Where's My Car free life for quite some time, and I'm perfectly happy with that. But I feel like I could sit down and maybe enjoy this movie. I feel the opposite way. I feel like watching it with commentary on is, no disrespect to A plus K and Sean Willy, but I feel like we're going to be watching it with three assholes talking over it, making jokes that are not, like sometimes it's good that a movie's not R-rated, sometimes that's okay.
If I knew that the commentary was them admitting that the movie's bad and apologizing for it being bad, I would be way into it then. But from what I can tell, it is not that. And basically, I had to give up on listening to creator commentary on movies after I listened to the greatest creator commentary of all time.
Oh, I was going to ask you about this. I was going to ask you if you enjoyed commentary.
I do. But they all pale in comparison to the commentary for the Coen Brothers movie Blood Simple.
Ooh, I bet that is a good one.
Well, here's why it's great. They got an actor to portray a film historian and just make shit up about the making of the movie.
Is he the same dude who's on the intro to The Big Lebowski from the Film Preservation Society?
No, there is an intro by that guy on Blood Simple.
So the Coen brothers have done multiple bits about fake film historians.
Yes.
On various movies.
There's that same film historian, film preservation guy is at the beginning of Blood Simple. And then the actual commentary is this British film historian / film expert who explains that a scene between two people talking in a car while it's raining had to be filmed backwards and upside down so it would look right. And that all the animals in the film are animatronic or CGI, even though that movie predates CGI by probably 15 years. It's all made up. It's the best. And I don't think there will ever be a better film commentary.
Now, I don't watch a lot of movies with commentary on. My favorite movie with commentary, and really the only movie that I've watched start to finish with the commentary on, rather than just being kind of idly curious about it. And this will not surprise anyone, but it's the 1966 Batman movie, sure, which has commentary by Adam West and Burt Ward.
Sure.
And it's great because about halfway to three quarters of the way through, Burt Ward just stops referring to Adam West as Adam and starts just calling him Batman, which is one of my favorite things that has ever happened in movies or in life.
That's pretty fantastic. All right, before we get going on this thing, I want to read a couple of critic quotes about this movie. USA Today wrote, "Any civilization that can produce a movie this stupid probably deserves to be hit by famine and pestilence."
Well, you know what? That might have come true.
You're right.
Because, look, it's been kind of downhill since 2000 for America.
I'm not going to top that, but the New York Post wrote, "This is an almost chuckle-free mess, so amateurish and lame that the cast often has that embarrassed look that you see on dogs given ridiculous haircuts."
Oh my god, that sounds amazing.
So, that is what we're in for. A weird cast in this movie. Like, Ashton Kutcher went on to do not a lot, right?
I don't know. Ashton Kutcher's had a pretty solid career over the past 15 years.
He was on Two and a Half Men. He was Charlie Sheen's replacement on Two and a Half Men.
Okay, well, I mean, before that.
Which, don't get, like, go read some articles about the series finale of Two and a Half Men.
Oh, did it finally end?
Yes. And the end of that show is like a fucking fever dream. The entire last season of that show is like a fucking fever dream. But the final scene is the most bananas, stupid, terrible thing. Like, there's nothing emotional about it. It's just vindictive and awful.
All right, literally, when we finish recording this, the first thing I'm going to do is go read an article about Two and a Half.
There's an article on Grantland about it. Go read it.
That sounds good.
Go read it.
The thing I was going to say is that, I mean, he's worked pretty steadily. And right before Two and a Half Men, it looked like he was kind of going to do that thing where, you know, the comedic actor who's like in his mid to late 30s is going to start taking some dramatic roles. Because
did that Steve Jobs movie, which from all I can tell is very bad, right? But then Sean William Scott, while maybe arguably not as successful as Ashton Kutcher, I think has been in much better movies and much better stuff since this. Like Role Models is pretty good. It's funny. There's a movie, and I forget the title of it, but there was a small movie that he made with, I'm blanking on his name, Dr. Steve Brule.
John C. Reilly.
John C. Reilly. Where they were competing. I think it's called The Promotion. I think the movie is called The Promotion. And it's about two of them competing for a managerial job at a grocery store. And it's really funny.
Can I just say that I love that the role that you could think of for John C. Reilly was Dr. Steve Brule, which is, and I'm not criticizing because I'm sure that's exactly where I would have landed too.
Sure.
But that was delightful to me.
By the way, I do not consider Tim and Eric to be stoner humor. People say it is, but I don't think it is at all. It's anti-humor. It's a different thing.
Yeah, it is a completely different thing. I should also say Sean William Scott was amazing on Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Sean William Scott, I actually have like respect for that guy. Jennifer Garner is in this movie.
Oh, wow.
Very young Electra. Jennifer Garner.
Electra herself.
And Christy Swanson is in this movie as a character named Christy Boner.
Oh, this is going to be good. So this thing's got Electra and Buffy.
The original Buffy.
So this is like, would you say that we're about to see like a real girl power movie?
I bet we are. A lot of like funny character actors in this movie too. David Herman is in this. who did a bunch of voices on Futurama. Mary Lynn Ricegub is in this. She was on Mr. Show, and she was Chloe on 24. Still don't think it's going to be good. We've been doing intro for 20 minutes. I do not think we can stall any longer, Chris.
Yeah, one last thing I wanted to point out, that this is the, I think, first Movie Fighters that we've ever recorded at night. Normally we do our show in the afternoon, so I am drinking coffee.
Yeah.
All while we are recording. I will not be having any coffee. I just have water, and I might have some apple juice. So this should make for a different listening experience for everyone.
All right, we're going to pause this. We're going to watch Dude, Where's My Car? With the director and stars on commentary.
The shibby commentary.
We're going to come back and we're going to talk about it. Well, everybody, we're back from watching Dude, Where's My Car? With the commentary.
Can I just say that two things I want to note. Okay. Number one, I honestly asked you if we could just stop 97 seconds into this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I really wish we had.
The second thing is that if you were here in our studio at the house where me and Matt live together,
right?
If you were on this Skype call, if you were sitting here with us, you just would have heard us like silently watching a movie for 90 minutes.
I think
we just put our heads down. Like, we got to get through this.
Occasionally we would chime in. Well, part of it was hard to talk because the commentary, like, I felt like we should have been listening to the commentary because we were asked to listen to the commentary. But it was hard to talk because they were talking nonstop. This is something I said pretty early on as we were watching the movie. If the movie itself is a stoner movie, is a pot movie, the commentary is a cocaine commentary.
Oh, yeah. These dudes are, like, super high energy and they maintain it. Even though they're drinking through the whole thing,
yeah,
they keep talking by the end of it.
They keep talking about getting beers, or like, "Hey, can we stop the recording to get some more beer?"
Now, I gotta say, if you've been listening lately, you have heard us talk about like there'll be moments in the movies where we just kind of get distracted, where we start playing the Marvel Puzzle Quest, you know, check out our phones or whatever. Having the commentary on kind of forced us to pay attention, and I do not like that.
Yeah, it was not. I think we were asked to watch this movie with commentary because it maybe makes it a little more interesting, but if anything, it made the whole experience that much more stressful. It just right, made it super stressful.
Like, in order to keep up with the actual events of the movie, you and I both turned on subtitles.
Right.
So we were listening to the commentary and we were reading the subtitles as we were like it. I have never paid so much attention to a Movie Fighters movie as I did with this one, because I had to listen to it and read it at the same time while watching the movie.
The sad thing is, I think, and I guess it's by virtue of the fact that this movie is basically plotless, right? Like,
it is and it isn't. But we'll talk about that in a second. But yes, like, largely it is a series of events.
But it I was paying so much attention to the movie and so not engrossed by it and so confused by the events that were occurring. Oof. Before we get going on what happens in the movie, I want to read a note that my wife came in here and wrote to me as we were watching it.
Okay.
Because I just started looking at her and like shaking my head and being like, this is even worse than I could have expected it to be. She wrote, "I had friends in high school who quoted this movie a lot. I hated it."
Oh, that's not very shibby of them.
Not shibby at all. Can I say how much I am glad that the word shibby. Never caught on, by the way.
Is there a like slang like that in a movie that has ever caught on?
People often use the phrase "stop trying to make fetch happen" from Mean Girls.
Yeah, I mean that's true.
But they don't actually use fetch.
Stop trying to make fetch happen is the only slang we can think of from a movie. I'll tell you what, Movie Fighters listeners, write in and let us know if you have used slang from a movie. Maybe there's something I'm just forgetting.
And that originated in a movie that you haven't heard elsewhere.
Literally no one outside of this movie has ever said something was shibby.
Yeah.
Or maybe they have. Maybe you and me were just out of touch.
Could we be so out of touch?
I'm not out of touch. It's children who are wrong.
That's right. All right. Here we go. Here's what happens in this movie. There's an opening credit sequence. There's space. There's a Smash Mouth song.
Wait. Was there a Smash Mouth song? Because I did not hear that.
It's a Smash Mouth song.
I watched a movie with... What did I watch that had two Smash Mouth songs in it? Oh, it was Princess Diaries 2, Royal Engagement, that I watched this weekend.
A movie I like a lot, which is called Rat Race, ends with, "Hey, it's Smash Mouth," and then there's a Smash Mouth concert. That's my our mutual friend Ben Gully has repeatedly told people, just turn the movie off when you hear, "Hey, it's Smash Mouth," which is good advice.
I think that's the new The End. Okay, so here's my question. Are we talking about the events of the movie, or are we talking about the commentary? Because if we're talking about the commentary, my first complaint is right here at the top.
Let's talk about the movie first, then the commentary. But since the opening credit, like all that's really happening in the opening credits is the commentary, and okay. Seeing like some ostriches and a guy in a goofy costume, we can talk about the commentary in the opening credits at this point. So, what is your first complaint?
All right, if you are watching this movie with the commentary, here's the first thing you hear when the movie starts. Because the commentary punches in, and these dudes are already cracking up, having a real good time way back in the year 2000.
They're already very aggressive. Like,
they're so
aggressive. First thing.
And super high energy, which is to their credit. You know, nobody wants to listen to a bunch of tired-ass dudes talk about movies, right? Except the listeners of this podcast. So once the actual movie starts, the first thing you hear is, and I believe it's Sean William Scott, it might be the director, there's a shot of Mitzi Martin, who plays, well, I mean, I'm not going to spoil it, but she plays a very attractive lady. And the first thing someone says after the movie starts is, "Oh, these girls make me so horny." And I feel like that sets the tone
for
the rest of the film.
Every time a woman appears on screen... Throughout the commentary, there has to be a comment on how she is hot, how one of the actors tried to talk to them on set. There's one girl in a strip club scene that Sean William Scott talks about trying to cheat on his girlfriend with.
No, he actually talks about how she was into him, but he didn't want to cheat on his girlfriend. And Ashton Kutcher tries to convince him that as long as he didn't do anything back, it wouldn't have been cheating, which is spurious.
As Bill Clinton, Marlene is trying to chime in on that from the other room. As Bill Clinton would say, "Eating ain't cheating."
That's a good Clinton joke for this 2000 era commentary.
Yeah. All right. That's a Scott Aukerman thing. A Scott Aukerman / Paul F. Tompkins thing, where they just constantly try to help Bill Clinton each other with eating ain't cheating. All right. Anyway, so the credits happen. We'll talk more about the commentary later. But
all right, let's talk about the plot. Because to this movie's credit, it was not the movie I was expecting.
It is not. Well, okay. I have some major complaints about.
Oh, I've got major complaints, Matt.
About the way this movie is put together. But I will say this. There is... Chekhov's rules are observed. There is pudding that appears, and then it plays a role later in the movie, which we would not have expected.
We would not, because first of all, the pudding is actually one of like maybe three solid gags in the movie.
Yeah,
these two dopes, these two pothead assholes.
In the Wikipedia description of the movie, they are described as slackers.
I think that's fair. Yeah. I think that's fair. Jesse and Chester, or as we will be calling them, Ashton Kutcher and Sean William Scott, A+K and Sean Willie.
Yeah.
I wonder, what's his Twitter name?
I don't.
How many followers do you think Sean William Scott has? We got to find this out real quick.
Couple hundred thousand, I would. He might have broken a million. A+K has got, what, 10 million followers?
Oh, yeah. He's a boring as shit. Okay, first of all, his is I Am Sean Scott. The second of all, not verified, which is bullshit.
This is not him. This is not really him.
This is not him?
This can't really be him. This only has 6,168 followers.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, was that I have more followers than Sean William Scott. That doesn't seem
this,
right.
This is a fake. This is a fake account.
Okay. Well, it's the first result for Google.
It's the first result when you search for him on Twitter. It's not him. Like, maybe he's not on Twitter.
Okay, well, so Sean William Scott, not on Twitter.
There's no way this I Am Sean Scott account is him. The most recent tweet is, yeah, I love going to airports hearing Stifler, you fuckface. As dumb as he is in this commentary, that this can't be him.
I think you're right. I think we're gonna have to rule Sean William Scott not on Twitter.
Yeah.
So anyway, we will just be referring to these characters as A+K and Sean Willie.
Yeah. Okay. So they wake up at Jesse's house. They can't remember the previous night. Their fridge and all their cabinets are full of pudding, and they don't know where it came from.
They open up the fridge, and Sean William Scott looks at Ashton Kutcher and says, "Did we get so high last night that we bought a lifetime supply of pudding and we don't remember it?"
Right.
And Ashton Kutcher then opens the cabinet next to it, and it is also full of pudding. And he says, "Yeah, I think so." Which is if every gag in this movie would have been half that good,
yeah,
then we would have had a much better time.
We didn't laugh. But it's not bad. Apparently,
no, we didn't laugh because I was already in a sour mood from the 3 minutes of commentary that led up to that.
True. Apparently, there was a scene filmed where they actually ate all that pudding, but it was not kept in the movie. Okay. They also check their answering machine, year 2000, and it's got an angry message from their twin girlfriends, Wanda, who is played by Jennifer Garner, and Wilma, who is played by Marla Sokolov,
you may remember her from The Practice.
Who don't really look like twins. They look like maybe sisters.
This is where we disagree. I think they do. They don't look exactly alike. They do look enough alike that I feel like they could be sisters. They are meant to be twins, but not identical twins, obviously, yeah, because yeah. Jennifer Garner is like 6 inches taller than Marla Sokolov.
Maybe probably taller than that. Like, there's a definite big height difference between them.
She's
anyway,
a very tall young lady.
She is tall. She was Elektra, after all. They are mad because they can't find Sean William Scott and Ashton Kutcher. So Sean William Scott and Ashton Kutcher are like, oh, we got to go to their house. They go outside. They can't find.
You're not going to believe it.
They can't find Jesse's car.
And one of them asks the other. I guess it's Chester.
Yeah.
Or Jesse asks, dude, where is my car?
The titular question, as the commentary observes. And they talk about how much they like the word titular. And then Chester replies,
because it sounds like titties.
Yeah. Chester replies,
I just got that.
Where's your car, dude? Now, this kicks off sort of the theory I have about this movie, which is that it is a collection of stuff stolen from other movies.
I think there's merit to this theory.
That entire exchange is stolen from The Big Lebowski when they walk outside of the bowling alley and Donnie's like, hey, where's your car, dude?
The movie where one of the characters is literally named The Dude and his missing car is a plot point for much of it.
Yeah. Or his continually destroyed car.
Okay, here's what we're going to do, Matt. We're going to talk about all the movies that we think this movie like blatantly stole pieces from. And I want to know if you think this movie is better or worse. So this movie, better or worse than The Big Lebowski?
Much worse.
Really?
Yeah. Okay.
You know what? I'm gonna begrudgingly agree with you.
Okay.
I do think this movie is not as good as my favorite film.
These are gonna be tough, I'm sure. Okay. So their twin girlfriends are mad at them, but they also, it's like Valentine's Day, I guess.
So it's their anniversary.
It's their anniversary. Okay. They have the same anniversary, which is weird.
Because they're dating twins. Obviously.
So they start dating at the same time. Got it.
Yeah, of course.
But the twins
like
have...
Like you and me, I made sure to start dating my girlfriend on your wedding anniversary.
Right. The girlfriends have promised them a special treat, however. So they're like very urgently trying to find their car.
Because they have special gifts that they bought for their girlfriends in the car.
So there's a scene where they go to a coffee shop and they talk to Christy Swanson, whose entire character is just an attractive lady. And yeah. There's a lot of the commentary about how, like, Christy Swanson, they thought Christy Swanson was the hottest woman of all time. And when they were younger. And
here's what's weird, though, is that they talk about being kids and seeing her in The Getaway, which is a movie where Christy Swanson stars opposite Charlie Sheen,
mm-hmm.
who would later, of course, be replaced on Two and a Half Men by Ashton Kutcher.
How things circle back around. They meet Christy Swanson, which leads to them encountering Jerry O'Connell's brother.
And when he showed up, I said, who's this dude who looks like Rip Jerry O'Connell?
Yep.
Not realizing it was his brother.
They're like the jock crew of the movie. And they don't really matter. Then they go to a strip club that they found out they were at the night before. And there are so many terrible things going on in this scene.
Yeah, this is where the movie really turned. This is where the movie kind of went bad on us.
This is where we both were just like, ugh, fuck this.
Because, like, at this point, I mean, look, 90 seconds, like a minute and a half in, I wanted to turn this off just because I knew it was going to be an hour and a half of listening to these assholes talk. They're assholes. I was going to say no offense, but you know what? Yeah, they're kind of assholes.
There's a lot of...
They refer to women as broads at one point.
They do.
Multiple points.
There's a lot of talk about how being gay is hilarious.
Yeah, just inherently.
I mean, there's a lot in this movie about how being gay is hilarious, too. But and there's a lot of use of like gay as a pejorative, oh dude, I was like, that's so gay, like that kind of thing. There is multiple cases of the use of the word retard in the commentary.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's all real bad. And then in the strip club scene, this is the thing where Sean William Scott talks about possibly cheating on his girlfriend. They pick out extras in the background that they wanted to have sex with or would like to have sex with. And then there's a scene where Ashton Kutcher is taken off into another room and is attacked by a transgender stripper who they apparently owe money to.
Right. Who refers to herself as being gender challenged, which I'm sure they thought was fucking hilarious.
Yeah. In the movie itself, she calls herself gender challenged. In the commentary, they keep fucking calling her transsexual, and she's not, because there is a straight up Ace Ventura 2, or was that in the first Ace Ventura movie?
That was in the first Ace Ventura. Are you thinking of thinking of Finkel and Einhorn, bro.
Yeah. Okay.
How did we make it through the 90s?
I don't know.
I saw that movie multiple times when I was 12.
But okay, so the first Ace Ventura had the character that turned out to be transgender at the end, and everybody was like, "Ugh!" Right? That is exactly this character.
Yeah,
and it is exactly how it is treated, where it's just like on its face gross that someone with male genitals would want to live their life as a woman.
There's a lot. It's bad, dude. It's real bad.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I was not expecting it at all.
Me neither. It was like I was being punched in the face with this like terrible non-humor about somebody being transgender.
And the thing is, I was expecting everything else.
Yeah.
Like everything else I was expecting. Like, oh, you know, the kind of, you know, casual broed up homophobia. Like,
right.
You know, look. I went to a Southern high school in the 90s.
Sure.
Okay. Look,
I was around so many people that used gay as a pejorative term.
Yeah. Yeah.
And other words of that ilk.
I know what I'm getting into with this bullshit movie. I thought.
Yeah.
But that one, man, that one, oh boy.
It blindsided me.
Yeah, we were both like, oh, come on.
And the joke of that is that this stripper is super aggressive and has a deep voice. And in the commentary, they talk about how, like, they pitched her voice down a little bit, but she did have a deep voice. So, then there's a thing that I was surprised.
Behind the scenes fun facts.
Yeah. Then there was a thing that I was surprised made it into a PG-13 movie, because they continually talk about, like, stuff that didn't make it into this because it was PG-13. Including a little girl giving somebody the finger, but
to be fair, always hilarious.
Oh, definitely. That would have been
grabbing grandmas. Little girls flipping the bird.
I tell you though, if that little girl flipping Sean William Scott the bird had made it into this movie, it would have been my favorite thing in the movie.
Like this movie's so weird because it's so clearly a movie that was written intending to be an R-rated movie.
Yes,
because like they talk about it in the commentary, and it's kind of one of the more interesting things is that it's a complete stoner movie about two dudes who got so stoned that they don't remember what happened the night before that nobody smokes pot in because it's a PG-13 movie.
Just to wrap up the thing about the strip club, there's a thing where all the strippers pour water on their T-shirts.
They have like a wet T-shirt contest.
Like a wet T-shirt contest thing, and there's like very clearly visible nipples and stuff for a minute. And this is a PG-13 movie. I was not expecting that to happen. The only scene of pot smoking that occurs in this movie.
Which is – we skipped over this scene.
We skipped over it.
This is the first thing they do after they leave the house.
It doesn't matter because
this
stuff could come in any order.
Because we don't actually get a plot until a half hour till the end.
They go to see their spiritual advisor, who is played by David Herman. I assume that's what he is. Because they go to him.
He's their dealer.
He's their dealer. Okay. But they go to him to like try to help figure out where their car is.
I think referring to drug dealers as spiritual advisors is a hot new trend we need to start.
Well, he talks in this kind of like Zen. He talks like Yoda, right?
He talks like Yoda, which is, I mean, it's super fucking annoying.
But he's supposed to be this, like, Zen Buddhist guy, right? He's got, like a pagoda thing in his backyard and stuff like that. He's supposed to have, like, you know, Eastern religious stuff going on.
Right.
And he's supposed to, like, help them meditate and stuff. But then his dog smokes pot, and that's the only instance of smoking pot that happens in the entire movie, is a fucking terrifying dog puppet smokes pot.
The dog smokes pot out of a pipe shaped like the dog.
Yeah.
Which I want to say it was funny. Because, like, thinking about that, it sounds funny. But it wasn't.
Well, part of it was that the dog puppet was fucking terrifying and awful. I hated that dog puppet. I did not like it one bit. So on Wikipedia at this point, they just start listing off shit that happens in the movie. I'm just going to read what's on Wikipedia.
Okay.
Along the way, they encounter an angry transgender stripper. We talked about that. A belligerent Chinese drive-through speaker operator.
Okay. Now, this part we need to pause on, because this is this was a part that I didn't remember it before we started watching the movie, but I remember
it was in the commercials for the movie.
I remember kids in college talking about it, and it was in the commercials. And it's like they go to it's a bad stand-up routine. And look, we've all seen Mulaney. We know that even good stand-up bits can go south when you actually act them out. Sorry, I didn't mean to take a shot at John Mulaney. That was rude of me, and I apologize.
That was a low blow.
That was a low blow. I apologize to John Mulaney. I think New in Town is fantastic. But like it plays out like a bad stand-up routine. Like we started talking about it during the scene where it's a guy on stage going, you know, you ever go to these drive-thrus? Have you seen this? Have you seen these drive-thrus? The bit is that the person on the other end won't stop the order. She just keeps saying, and then. And they continue to order food, and then they try to stop ordering food, and they can't because the person just keeps saying, and then. She's not belligerent. They're being the belligerent, but, like, it's...
Yeah, because it eventually reaches a point where Ashton Kutcher starts going, no and then, no and then. First of all, I've never been through a drive-thru where as soon as your order was over, they didn't say, okay, drive around.
Yeah, and also, with something else we talked about, we have never been to or seen a Chinese restaurant with a McDonald's-style drive-thru.
Never.
Never.
Maybe they exist, but I've never seen one.
Right in. If you have a Chinese restaurant that you actually go through, like it's Taco Bell.
And don't send Panda Express, because that doesn't count.
Yeah, this is like a legit – this is like Egg Roll Chen in Colombia.
But I don't think I've ever seen a Panda Express with a drive-thru. Maybe Panda Expresses have drive-thrus. Some.
Third point, second genuinely funny gag in the movie is that the Chinese restaurant is named Chinese Food. With five O's in food.
Yeah, that's like a gag that you would see on, like, I don't know, in some trippy comic book. And I kind of appreciate that. But the whole thing where it's like she keeps saying and then, I think the gag of it is that she's supposed to be aggressive because she's Chinese and because it's Chinese food. Like, there's a weird racial element to it.
Yeah. It's not the most racist thing that happens in this movie. That comes later when we find out that they have learned to speak Chinese. Or no, it's Japanese. They've learned to speak Japanese.
Right. Yeah.
But I feel like it is, it's racist to Jace.
It's definitely racist to Jace.
Okay, and, so that's the Chinese. And that's the Chinese.
That whole thing just ends with Ashton Kutcher punching the box, the talk box. At the Chinese restaurant. And that's pretty much that. They discover two cool tattoos on each other's backs.
You've seen the trailer. You've seen how that goes.
Yeah. That all takes place in a Dumb and Dumber-like scene that ends with them putting on matching tracksuits, which is, or like different color tracksuits, which are just tracksuits instead of tuxedos.
Right. They put on tracksuits, and then they briefly do a music video to Bust a Move.
Yeah. And the commentary at that point is just like, I touched a bunch of girls' butts.
That's a good A+ game, bro.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah, and like, that scene is funny. Like, it's clever. Like, these two idiots, you know, are like... If you haven't seen the trailer in 15 years, what happens is one of them gets a tattoo that says dude, the other one gets a tattoo that says sweet. So they keep, and they're on their shoulders, so they keep asking the other one what it says. So the guy says, dude, what does mine say? Sweet, what does mine say? Dude, what does mine say? And it goes back and forth. That's a clever scene. They talk about it in the commentary like it's fucking Citizen Kane.
Well, they talk about it like it's an Abbott and Costello routine.
He's like, now this was the scene, guys. This was the one. I mean, they put this in the trailer, and this, like, really, I mean, we really nailed this one.
Well, according to IMDb, Ashton Kutcher was going to refuse to do this movie because he thought it was too stupid.
Unless he took his shirt off?
No. Then he got to this scene. and couldn't stop laughing, so he agreed
to do it. This is only like 20 minutes into the movie.
Yeah.
I like the idea that Ashton Kutcher thought this movie was too stupid. He was correct.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, also, he does, in this commentary, and look, they're actors. I'm sure they're playing it up, you know? I think. I would like to think. But, like, he does not come off as a guy who would refuse to do this movie because it was too stupid. Do you think he was already not wanting to get typecast as Kelso?
I mean, if he had a decent agent, they should have told him not to do this stupid fucking movie.
Well, but it was a hit, though. This movie made money.
But there's a scene where they get arrested.
Oh, well, they meet the what are credited as the jumpsuit chicks before that.
Right, and they are just some odd looking women in matching leather jumpsuits who keep asking these guys to find this MacGuffin. And what's the MacGuffin thing called?
I don't know.
Oh, here it is.
I don't know. I'm sorry, dude. I don't know.
The Continuum Transfunctioner.
Okay, yeah, the Continuum Transfunctioner.
They tell them to find this thing called the Continuum Transfunctioner, and if they do, they will give them erotic pleasure in exchange for that. Now, apparently, originally in the script, they told them, we will give you blowjobs. But because this is a PG-13 movie, they had to make that just oral pleasure, and then that got turned into erotic pleasure. Now, Chris, you and I had a conversation about how them saying blowjobs would probably be as funny as them saying erotic pleasure.
Yeah, because it's a weird thing where, like, it's this weird valley of comedy where it would actually be hilarious if Mitzi Martin and her squad of, you know, beautiful ladies in Emma Peel jumpsuits were just standing on the streets of this town saying, you know, if you tell us where it is, we will give you blowjobs. Like, that is actually, like, that is ludicrous enough to be funny. Whittling it down to erotic pleasure, also pretty funny. Like, I don't think oral pleasure would have been funny.
Right.
But erotic pleasure is such a weird thing, and considering what they turn out to be.
It's such an inhuman way of phrasing that.
Yeah, exactly. But
my point was, choosing between those two, and I'm doing quotation marks here, jokes, is like choosing between getting your arm broken and your leg broken. Like, they're both.
And then we talked for like 15 minutes about whether we would rather have our arms broken or our legs broken.
Okay. So while they're, when they first encounter those women in the jumpsuits, the police come driving up and arrest them. And I still don't know why they got arrested.
This is the second time I've had to explain this to you because you refuse to. You refuse to retain any information about this movie.
It's true.
They got arrested because the police who were arresting them had a description of two criminals that turn out to be a guy who is so jacked that I momentarily thought it was Bill Goldberg and a little person.
Okay.
Like, that's the joke. It's like, oh, we arrested you by mistake. We were actually looking for those two guys. And it's like, it's a cutaway gag. And you see the other two criminals being arrested.
Like, that's not quite like an airplane gag, but it's in that vein. Like,
yeah, it's we talked about how the police station scene with these, you know, these two dopes in tracksuits shoving donuts into their faces and doing some improv, like, was actually a pretty decent scene.
It was like it was from an entirely different movie.
Yeah,
because there are several kernels of good gags in that police station scene. Because there's a part where they're being interrogated by these two detectives, and because the police can't beat up suspects, there's one detective who just keeps beating up this mannequin and yelling and screaming and punching this mannequin. To try to intimidate them into talking.
Which, again, is actually a really funny gag. Like, that's number three.
Like, that is not a bad gag.
Because that's so bizarre and, like, so, like, if that would have, I'm trying to think of another movie where that would have been great.
But yeah,
like, it's almost Arrested Development.
But it's almost like, you know, Naked Gun or like Zucker Brothers shit, right? And
yeah.
And but the rest of this movie does not have that tone at all in the least. It does not have that madcap farce tone to it anywhere else. So, like, this scene does not fit anywhere, but it's also, like, maybe the funniest scene in the movie?
Yeah.
I don't know, but eventually they end up letting them go, and they go to the front desk and ask where A plus K's car is, and the cop tells them that he accidentally sent it to Impound, because I guess the police had it at one point.
Yeah, because they talk about how they, during their kind of pot-fueled... Okay, because the stripper gave them a briefcase full of money.
Right.
And so they went out, like, they bought the tracksuits, they leased a car, and they, at one point, just went by the police station with donuts for everybody, which is where the, like, actual comedy of that scene stops. Because it's easy jokes.
Yeah. So they find out that the car is an impound and that they're not going to be able to get it for a couple of days. That's that. Mm-hmm. The next thing that's listed is a group of UFO cultists led by Zoltan, who's played by Hal Sparks.
Yes. Hal Sparks, that's who he is.
Yeah.
Spider-Man's boss.
Spider-Man's boss, former... didn't Spider-Man just meet him in an elevator?
That's right. He's in Spider-Man's... Who's Spider-Man's boss? Spider-Man's boss is somebody, right? I mean, not J. Jonah Jameson. I know that.
The pizza guy?
Yeah.
Isn't that... the dude from The Daily Show?
To Jon Stewart?
No.
Craig Kilborn?
No. One of the correspondents.
Stephen Colbert?
No, but he was a correspondent on The Daily Show.
Asif Manvi.
Asif Manvi. That's who
the guy who I met when I was on The Daily Show.
Yeah.
I talked to him about that. Okay,
It was Asif Manvi. That was his boss. Also, these two guys work for a pizza dude. It doesn't matter, though.
It doesn't matter.
Don't worry about it. Okay. So, the whole thing about the Zoltan crew is they do a pretty weird hand symbol that makes a Z.
They make a Z.
Chloe from 24 is in their group, and there's some terrible talk in the commentary about her.
Oh, there really is.
About how they think she's the slut of the cult.
And that, like, that is a direct quote.
Yeah. It's gross. And there's something about the cultists kidnapping A plus K and Sean William Scott's girlfriends because they want them to find the continuum transfunctioner also. Look, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is all actually going to make sense at the end of this, like, when we actually get around to explaining what is actually happening in this movie.
Yeah.
But, like, it's weird for right now.
Okay. So the other group of people they run into are these two, quote-unquote, Nordic guys who remind me very much of the nihilists from The Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
Or the Proclaimers. You remember the band The Proclaimers?
I do remember The Proclaimers.
They were going to walk 500 miles?
They were going to do that. They would.
Oh, they would walk 500 more.
Hopefully it wouldn't be necessary. That was just them kind of, you know.
It was hyperbole for the sake of, like, expressing an emotion.
Right.
Anyway, they look kind of like the Proclaimers.
I would have rather watched the Proclaimers doing 90-minute concert than watch this movie.
I would have watched the Proclaimers walk 500 fucking miles.
Matt, you realize that would take several days.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
They're running around also trying to find the continuum transfunctioner and trying to find A plus K and Sean William Scott. And there's a scene where they go back to the Chinese restaurant and talk to the drive-thru box, and the drive-thru box tries to tell them and then as well. Ha ha!
It's a callback.
Callback for you.
Callback.
Okay. After the girlfriends get kidnapped by Zoltan and his cult.
This is the plot, by the way. This we is have where finally stumbled into the plot of the movie.
This is where the plot kicks in, but we have to take another detour first to an ostrich farm.
Well, the ostrich farm is the headquarters of the cult.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I guess that's right. Wait,
now,
I thought they went to the ostrich farm after.
No. The ostrich farm is the headquarters of the cult. The cult is headquartered in the barn, and they have locked up Andy Dick in a cage. And Brent Spiner is the farmer who owns the farm. And if it sounds like I'm having a stroke right now, I know, but I'm not. Those are actually things that happen in this movie.
And I think I'll say this is something that is said in the commentary at this point. Man, Andy Dick has got to be like the most brilliant comedian of all time.
Andy Dick is one of the funniest comedians of all time. Andy Dick.
There's a lot more improvising that occurs at this point between Andy
Dick. And Brent Spiner. They just went off book.
They were funnier off camera than on. You know what I'm saying?
Because guys, when you have an improv master like Brent Spiner, and you have one of the funniest comedian of all time, Andy Dick, you want to be a fly on the wall in that room. You just want to point a camera at the magic and let it happen.
Okay. They leave there.
What happens next is we turned off. I got up to go get snacks at one point.
There's some kind of thing where they steal a Mercedes and the Nordic guys are chasing after them. Then they find a key. Oh. They find
the
a key.
The jumpsuit girls also get Jerry O'Connell's brother to try to beat him up and get the transfunctioner.
Yeah.
Brent Spiner gives them a key to a locker at a Chuck E. Cheese.
That's where the key comes from. Brent Spiner gives it to them. It's for a locker at an arcade. So they go to the arcade and they open the locker. As soon as they open the locker, the transgender stripper shows up and says, "Hey, where's my money?" Luckily, the briefcase with all the money still in it, even though they spent a lot of it according to earlier in the movie, is in there. They give it to the transgender stripper, who appears with her. I think the person is referred to as her boyfriend, who has just like a drawn-on goatee, who is, you know, a woman with a drawn-on goatee,
and like, they make out like magic marker.
Yeah, and there's a scene like they give them the money. They make out. A plus K and Sean William Scott act super grossed out by two women making out in front of them.
Yeah.
Like mad grossed out. And then
not only in the movie, but on the commentary.
Yeah. And then they reach into the locker and get the rest of the stuff out, and they find a big bag full of tickets. They sort of realize that nobody knows what this continuum transfunctioner looks like, so they're going to fool Zoltan into thinking that one of the prizes for skee-ball is the continuum transfunctioner. So they trade in all their tickets. It's supposed to be 30,000 tickets. Their bag has maybe like 200 tickets inside of it.
Oh yeah, that was the maddest I got at this movie, was when they tried to pass off a little ass shopping bag as having 30,000 skee-ball tickets in it.
Yeah. They get this little device that looks kind of spacey and are going to try to pass it off as the continuum transfunctioner. Then everybody converges on this arcade. Jerry O'Connell's brother is there. The women in the jumpsuits are there.
This is like a Stefan sketch. The hottest new club is Dude, Where's My Car? This place has everything. Jerry O'Connell's brother. Hal Sparks wearing bubble wrap.
Women in jumpsuits.
A plus K.
A plus K. It's got everything you can imagine. A pizza man. And the original Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Okay, so, yeah, Jerry O'Connell's brother is there. Christy Swanson is there. Hal Sparks and his cult are there.
We didn't really talk about the Zoltan cultists. They wear, like, wrestling singlets under suits made of bubble wrap, like, with hoods.
Yes.
Which is, again, is a really silly and fun visual. But this movie manages to just, like, Dracula all the joy out of it.
Like, look, I was very glad that this movie was only 83 minutes. But no joke in it is given any time to breathe at all.
Yeah, that's another thing we talked about. And another thing was that 20 minutes into the commentary, the director of this movie goes, I mean, we've been watching this thing for like 40 minutes.
It was 23 minutes. The timestamp was 23 minutes, and they thought they had been watching it for 40. So, we're not the only ones, everybody. Okay, so everybody in the movie converges on this arcade, looking for the Continuum Transfunctioner, because A plus K and Sean William Scott say that they have found it. They try to pass off this thing that they traded in tickets for the MacGuffin, and just people look down and they see kids walking around with these things because they've traded in their skee ball tickets for them too. And they're just like, that thing's not the Continuum Transponder. Where is it? As this is all going on, Sean William Scott is solving a Rubik's Cube.
Yeah, and according to the Wikipedia article, it says he's been working on it for most of the movie, and that's bullshit.
I didn't notice it until they got to the arcade.
I do not remember seeing it before this scene.
He had it in the arcade as soon as they got there, but not before that. Couldn't have had it before that. When he solves the Rubik's Cube, it transforms, it morphs into this MacGuffin thing. And it starts counting down. Because apparently it's going to destroy the universe. Because the women in the jumpsuits and the Nordic guys are both aliens. Groups of aliens.
So this weird cult that Hal Sparks has led was actually intercepting real alien transmissions. They just are also super weird.
Yeah.
I guess.
And like, they don't even have any discernible technology to intercept these transmissions, but I guess they have.
No, they have bubble wrap suits and they live in a barn.
Yeah. Who cares? I don't care.
Seriously. Like, at this point, the movie has become a full-on sci-fi movie with an alien device that can destroy the universe. And part of me really respects that and enjoyed that, because that is a third act turn I did not see coming. Like, I have somehow managed to avoid being spoiled on that for 15 years. And I kind of like that it's a weird bait and switch. That you go in thinking you're going to see like a Kevin Smith style stoner comedy, and you do get that, but like then it becomes this completely different movie. The problem, of course, is that neither parts of that movie are very good.
Well, and here's the other thing: the whole idea of like a movie that has very, very low stakes suddenly turning into something that has very, very high stakes. Like, this movie starts out about being like, where's my car? And then by the end of it, it's like a universe-saving sci-fi thing. So many other things have done that better. Like, even that's kind of stolen from The Big Lebowski, weirdly enough. The Big Lebowski doesn't turn into a sci-fi thing, but it's a movie about a rug, right? The dude just wants his rug back. And then it turns into this, like, you know, Raymond Chandler neo-noir thing, right?
Right.
So, the like, even though, like, the low stakes to high stakes transition is not unoriginal in this movie.
Yeah, it's... Again, I was not expecting it, and I was like, it is on a certain level almost refreshing, or would have been if we were watching the movie and not listening to three jackasses talk over it. But like, again, it's still bad. And it's so like really bad.
And the reprieve is only momentary, because right. What happens when the thing starts going off and it starts counting down is that the two guys are like, okay, we got to figure out, because the women in the jumpsuits and the two Nordic guys start arguing about who they should give the device to. Like, who's going to let the universe be destroyed or who's going to turn it off? Mm-hmm. And they can't decide who to give it to. They can't decide who the good faction is. The way that they're going to figure this out is they're going to find out who knows a question about the night before. I don't know how this determines who's the good one. But they ask what they did on the 18th hole of the mini golf course the night before. And the Nordic guys say, you got a hole in one. And so they give them the MacGuffin. And the reason they know that they got a hole in one, even though they forgot everything from the night before, is that the prize for the hole in one is a lifetime supply of pudding. That is actually not terrible, right?
Yeah, I actually liked that. That good gag from the beginning ended up paying off.
That's Chekhov's pudding. However, the fact that the two dudes ended up being the good guys and the women who were trying to do transactional sex are the evil villains who then morph into a giant Playboy playmate. Again, it sounds like I am having a stroke right now. But they morph into a giant Playboy playmate who starts rampaging.
I literally had a dream last night where I was solving crimes on a cruise ship that makes more sense than this movie.
But
I broke up a dogfighting ring on the lower decks of a cruise ship with my friend Kieran, who lives in Manchester.
Obviously, the women who are going to try to do transactional sex are the bad people, right?
Yeah, I don't even – like, at this point, it's just like – they form a giant woman. It rips off Steven Universe 15 years in advance. So
this Playboy playmate who, again, the commentary is just like, I got a boner.
She's really cool, though. She's a really cool girl.
She's a cool broad. She's a
really cool broad.
Yeah. She starts rampaging. There's a thing where, like, there's a big panty shot where she's like stepping over a picnic table, and a kid tells his dad, hey, dad, I want to go on that ride. And the dad goes, me too, son.
Fuck off with that.
They end up on the mini golf course. There's this thing where like everybody who is not A+K and Sean William Scott is telling them to use this one particular weapon on the MacGuffin. Apparently, they all know that this thing is supposed to kill the giant Playboy Playmate lady. They turn it so that that's going to turn on, but they can't figure out how to turn it on. They can't push the button. This has not been established at all that Sean William Scott watches a lot of Animal Planet, but apparently he watches a lot of Animal Planet, and he remembers a show about how apes use crude tools.
They see that earlier in the movie.
Oh,
but like it's just like they're like, oh, we should watch some Animal Planet now.
I don't even remember that happening in the movie. But he remembers that apes use crude tools. So he pulls out a twisty straw. He pushes the button. The giant Playboy Playmate lady gets zapped. There's a gag about a giant pair of panties falling on a guy. And then that's the movie?
And then someone off screen goes, damn, those are some big-ass panties.
Yeah. Then there's a hilarious gag reel where Sean William Scott and A+K act gay. Woo! Okay, before we go on to high points, low points, whatever, do we want to talk about the commentary? Any other commentary points we want to mention?
It's just, it's so bad. It's like all the absolute worst.
I think we've pretty much covered it. I don't think there's anything else to say about the commentary much.
Yeah, it's like every... Like, look, this movie is full of beautiful women. Christy Swanson is beautiful.
Oh, by the way, they make sure to point out that you can see Christy Swanson's nipples through her shirt.
Jennifer Garner is beautiful. Marla Sokoloff is beautiful. Mitzi Martin is beautiful. The playmate who becomes the giant space chick or whatever the line is, the Chiron that she gets, beautiful. Like, but these, it is like it is every frat boy stereotype come to life in the recording of a commentary track for a movie. It is the three people who would see this movie and love this movie talking about how hilarious this movie is.
All right, Chris. Do we have any high points at all for Dude, like, Where's My Car
of the movie or the commentary?
Either or.
Okay. Of the movie, the pudding gag is solid. The return of the pudding gag is solid. And I admire the ambition of this movie. Like, I do admire that it, like, it's not necessarily just half-baked, you know? It does try to turn into something else at the end.
But even then, I think it's just a silly, stupid ripoff of Dumb and Dumber and The Big Lebowski.
You're already in low points, bro. You're already in low points.
I know, but I'm counterpointing your high point. Because Dumb and Dumber also does that low stakes into high stakes thing. Here's my one high point, that the pudding came back.
Fair enough.
That's
fair
it. Enough. That's the only thing. All right.
I hear you angrily tapping over there.
We're already into low points, so let's do low points.
Okay, well, this movie's really poorly written.
It's really poorly shot. It's really poorly, like, there's so much racism and
homophobia.
Homophobia.
And transphobia.
Yes.
Like, it feels...
We skipped over the part where we find out that they learned Japanese.
Yeah, but that, like, you don't need to hear anything else
When they're pulling stuff out of the locker at the arcade, they find these, like, diplomas that tell them that they know Japanese. And then they start saying stuff in Japanese. That's not really the racist part. There's a part in the gag reel where Ashton Kutcher just does gibberish Japanese. That's abysmal. It's abysmally terrible. What else, Chris?
It's just really... It is really poorly structured. Like, from a, like, just a, like you said, halfway through this movie, you're like, oh, okay, this is just a series of unrelated gag side trips. And then the plot actually shows up at the end. But you can't, like, you can't just have half a movie that's unrelated to the rest of the movie. You know, it's not really, all right, look, The Hangover is another movie I haven't seen. But as I understand it, that movie is about kind of piecing together the events of the previous night, right?
The Hangover does a decent job of making that stuff into something, into a story.
Yeah. They never, like, this is not a movie about them piecing together the events of the night before in order to solve the problem. In this case, the destruction of the universe by the, what the fuck it is, Transfunctionator.
Yeah, whatever. Who cares?
Whatever. I don't care. Like, it's just, like, really, it's really bad. Like, it's really bad.
Yeah.
And it's so much worse with commentary.
The commentary is so assaultive. I was so happy at those moments where they were like, hey, let's stop this and get another beer. Because for 30 seconds to a minute, I didn't have to listen to them.
Yeah, they are extremely off-putting on commentary. Here's what I found out. Like, the first thing we talked about when we started recording was I talked about, you know, you talked about how you don't like stoner comedy, and I talked about how much I really enjoy Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. Like, I think it's funny. And same director, Danny Liner, same director.
No kidding.
Has also worked on Arrested Development, another thing that I brought up while we were watching this, as an example of something better.
How? Like, based on this commentary, I can't stand him.
Yeah, no, and like, now I'm like, exactly. Now I'm like, do I really like that movie? Because yeah. I definitely do not, like, he does not come off well in this. And look, to be fair, if you had a recorded conversation with me from the year 2000, I would probably come off as a huge fucking dick.
Well, no. I would love to know if you played this commentary for Ashton Kutcher, Sean William Scott, and Danny Liner today, 15 years removed from this, how they would react to it. Because I – listen.
Ashton Kutcher would have to get somebody else to handle his commentaries from now on.
As you just said, if you sat down and recorded me in the year 2000 when I was 16 years old, I would have said some fucking dumb shit. And I probably would have been like, oh, that girl's hot. I got a boner. Check that girl out. Like, constantly.
And I would have been like, oh, dude, you're so gay.
Yeah. What blows my mind is that these guys are two professional actors who have been working for a while when this movie was made. Like, Ashton Kutcher had been on That 70s Show. Sean William Scott, I think, had been in stuff. And by all
accounts, he had been in American Pie.
Okay. And I assume Danny Liner had been in some stuff, right? Or had directed some stuff before this, or
I don't know. I think this might be his first thing.
Well, it really shows, because, like, I can't imagine. Maybe I'm totally mistaken about the level of professionalism in film, but I can't imagine that most people on most film sets, even like lecherous dudes, are constantly talking about how hot all the girls are. At all times.
Look, I mean, Ashton Kutcher was 22 at the time, okay? So, again, you know, he's a young dope. He's sure. A young dope.
It seems like even at 22 years old, you should be like, even if I find all these women attractive, maybe I shouldn't constantly talk about it.
Maybe I shouldn't constantly talk about how I kept trying to get the strippers back to my trailer.
Yeah.
But, like, okay. This movie.
Final thoughts on Dude, Where's My Car?
This movie's really terrible. I suspect that if I would have seen it in 2000, I would have loved it. And that makes me want to have one of those scenes where I go, like, take a walk down by the lake and skip some stones and think about things.
I remember actively avoiding it, though, when it came out.
Well, I'll tell you exactly why I avoided it, because I do too. I was told in high school by friends of mine, they were like, bro, you gotta see American Pie. Chris, this is your kind of movie. You're gonna love it. That movie's fucking garbage. And I recognized that even when I was like 16, 17, whenever the hell that came out.
Yeah.
So like when Dude, Where's My Car came out, I was like, no thank you. I'm just going to watch me some anime. Or whatever the fuck I was watching in 2000. I've got WrestleMania 2000 on the N64. I do not need to go to the movies.
I have two final thoughts about this movie. One is that apparently this movie was originally intended to be a Beavis and Butthead sequel. Like, this was an early draft of this movie was a Beavis and Butthead sequel. A sequel to Beavis and Butthead Do America.
You know, that makes sense, because one of the things that we didn't talk about High Points, but that I remarked about during the movie, was that there is a new scene every 3 minutes about, like, clockwork. This movie does move.
Yeah.
It doesn't move very well, but
there's
it
a,
moves.
There's a mention in the commentary about how this movie is a cartoon, and that is true. Like, it's structured in some ways like a cartoon. like an animated film would be. And if it was animated, I maybe would have forgiven it a lot more. But imagine how much better this movie would have been if Mike Judge had taken a pass at that script and it had been a Beavis and Butthead movie.
Oh, man, it would have been great.
It would have been nothing like this.
I mean, it probably wouldn't have been great, but it would have been weirdly enjoyable.
Yeah, I like Beavis and Butthead. I remain to this
day. I like Beavis and Butthead, too. I like Office Space, too. But I feel like Mike Judge kind of falls apart in the longer form.
Fair. I think that's fair. Yeah. I'm glad he's got Silicon Valley now to back on TV.
Seeing this movie, I want to walk over to my DVD shelf and be, because like, look, I'm a dude who owns Harold and Kumar. I'm a dude, like, I saw Super Troopers 4 times in the theater. Do I really like Super Troopers? Or was that just like, have I changed so much from when I was a teenager?
I'm gonna do this. I had to purchase this DVD, as I mentioned earlier. You did. I'm holding it right now. I feel like my final thought about this movie should be to throw this DVD across the room. So here we go. I'm going to frisbee it across my office. Here we go.
It's a good hit.
Yeah, it sounded pretty nice. I would
throw mine, but it belongs to Netflix.
It belongs to Netflix.
I can't believe you had to pay out of pocket for this experience.
I'm expensing it. I'll tell you that, my friend.
Write it off, bro. Write it off.
I think that's it for this episode of Movie Fighters. We didn't even mention that they found their car at the end of the movie. It was behind a mail truck.
It was there the whole time. Oh, shit! Matt! We didn't talk about the last thing that happens in the movie.
They repeat the dude sweet gag?
No. They go to their girlfriends and give them their presents, and the aliens give them a necklaces that makes their girlfriend's boobs grow bigger. And the director, Danny Liner, says, look, I hope nobody went out and got implants because of this movie.
Boobs are great, too.
Small boobs are great, too. They're perky, which is such a weird... Oh, this movie's going to haunt me, dude. This movie's going to haunt me.
I think I actually went into a fugue state and blocked the thing about their boobs getting bigger out of my brain.
Yeah, yeah. Because you know who's not hot enough is Jennifer Garner and Marla Sokoloff.
Yeah. Okay, look, everybody. That's it for this Movie Fighters.
That's it for Movie Fighters. We're done.
That's it for our Kickstarter backer demands.
And that's right. Folks, we are in control.
Folks, I think on our next episode, we may have to do a palate cleanser. So stay tuned for that. We may have to just watch a movie we like next time. Because this one was rough. Myra Breckinridge was bad. Look, I think this was a better movie than Myra Breckinridge, but only just. And the experience of watching it was as bad as watching Myra Breckinridge, I feel.
Mm-hmm. No.
Maybe
no
not. Way. Maybe not. It was pretty bad.
You're in the moment with this movie right now, but like, no. This wasn't even as bad as Short Circuit 2, to be honest with you.
I don't know. It's at least on par with Short Circuit 2 for me. Okay. Because Short Circuit 2 didn't have that fucking assaultive commentary.
Yeah, but it had the robot.
We're going to think real hard about our next episode, everybody. Come back and see what it is in 2 weeks. Our theme music is by Michael Kill. Our website was designed by Sean Balgus. See you in 2 weeks, folks.
This has been a Kaleidos Media production.